Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. We've got an exciting guest today. His name is Larry Penner. He's a transportation historian, an advocate, a writer, and he shared some thoughts with us after we had posted information that recognized that there was an intention to build four new Metro North stations in the Bronx. And it was a fascinating story. It was compelling. It was interesting. It was, oh my God, this is like phenomenal stuff. And then, but it was devoid of any other input. And it was just a press release. It was very exciting, but it seemed to wallow somehow because there was information that was missing, and we wouldn't have known about it unless Larry Penner wrote in. And before we even begin to talk about Larry Penner, I guess we should just point out that he is a transportation historian, he's an advocate, he's a writer. He was also, he worked for the United States Department of Transportation Federal Transit Administration, Region Number 2 in New York office, and the responsibilities he had were vast. He oversaw and reviewed and approved and was overseer of billions of dollars in capital assistance grants to the MTA, including Metro North, and that made him so informed. And he's still informed to this day. So let me welcome Mr. Penner. How are you, sir? What a pleasure
Very
to meet
good.
You on the phone.
Thank you for the honor of sharing my knowledge and wisdom with your listeners.
Absolutely, and thank you for sharing it even in the writing the first time. It was about the third week in January that we found out about this project. And unless we had heard from you, we wouldn't realize that there were many different transportation projects that were being contemplated, that were even mentioned as going to be built. And yet, each one of these different segments of the transportation world that we're hoping to develop, whether it be the airport train or whether it be additional stations in the Bronx or connecting Rockland County with New York, everything having to do with the train station in New York City, Penn Station, everybody wanting to connect there, including New Jersey Transit. How did this come about that it seems to be almost, I don't know what the right word is, a conflict in vision because we can't seemingly do it all, can we?
No. The problem is there's only a finite amount of capacity and funding available for transportation improvement projects. And what fascinates me, since I've been retired, I've been tracking elected officials who will travel around the metropolitan New York area. They'll make one promise for constituents in Long Island, Nassau, and Suffolk, another promise for constituents in Queens, another one for the Bronx, et cetera, et cetera. And very often the promises conflict. I think Governor Cuomo is a primary example. All transportation agencies, whether it's MTA or New Jersey Transit or Amtrak, have five-year and 20-year capital needs documents and assessments and five-year and 20-year capital plans. And Penn Station is kind of like ground zero. Just for the benefit of your listeners, it's shared by Amtrak, New Jersey Transit, and Long Island Railroad. And there are four tunnels that go into the East River to feed into Penn Station. Three tunnels go in the morning. One goes outbound for reverse movements or trains that's midday storage in Sunnyside Yard for New Jersey Transit and Amtrak. Then in the afternoon, you have three tunnels going east for rush hour service and one tunnel going inbound to Penn Station to provide additional trains for service. There's something called the West Side Storage Yard for Long Island Railroad, and trains come out of that storage yard, and when they run out of trains, they count on trains making another trip in from the east. And what the elected officials who are making the promises for Metro North Penn Station access don't tell your listeners, readers, writers, and taxpayers in the Bronx and Westchester and the Hudson Valley who use the New Haven line is that Governor Cuomo has made multiple commitments for additional service into Penn Station. I'll briefly highlight there's $400 million being invested for double tracking the Ronkonkoma branch, $2.6 billion for mainline third track. When Long Island Railroad gets access to Grand Central Terminal in 2022, and I'll believe it when I see it, a cat has nine lives. The original completion date was 2009. Mm-hmm. So assuming Long Island Railroad gets access to Grand Central Terminal in December of 2022, the game plan is to wait a year or two, and then Metro North service, hypothetically, would start into Penn Station. What you're, most people are not aware of is at the same time, there are commitments for additional rush hour service into Penn Station on a Ronkonkoma Long Island Railroad branch, which will be several trains an hour. There are commitments to start service to the Belmont Arena, several trains, and this reverse commute service commitment to Penn Station and Long Island Railroad. And the LaGuardia Air train for $1.5 billion, the governor has promised a 30-minute trip from LaGuardia Airport via the air train. That means six more trains an hour into Penn Station. All these trains have to fit into Penn Station. On top of that, in recent years, there are more and more service breakdowns on the East River Tunnel or between Woodside and the portals to East River Tunnels. So that means Long Island Railroad has to combine and cancel trains. So the question of the hour is, no one's ever shared a master plan in terms of how you would integrate Metro North access into Penn Station with all these other new services I've talked about.
Well, when you brought up all these issues, the conflicts that arose, the lack of funding for this, that, and the other project, and even a shortfall on the projects that they were first contemplating, the thing that's interesting is they never really delved into the centerpiece of it all, as you mentioned, Penn Station. Was there even consideration to build even further underground from Penn Station in order to accommodate all these trains that were anticipated into the future that goes all the way up to, like, what, 2040, 2050?
It's very expensive. As part of the $29 billion gateway project, New Jersey Transit proposed building a new terminal, which would be a little bit south of the existing terminal, but the cost was prohibitive, $6 billion. A gateway tunnel is the perfect example where there's no money to do it. So imagine, how would you find $6 billion to accommodate a new terminal for New Jersey Transit? The gateway tunnel project for $29 billion, for example, there's no real financial commitment from New York and New Jersey. They want to fund their share of the gateway tunnel with federal loans as opposed to bringing hard cash to the table. So you're very astute. One of the basic questions taxpayers and transit riders should be asking elected officials to hold them accountable: what is your specific funding source by year? Is it in the existing MTA five-year capital plan, the next five-year capital plan? And it's just not, the money's just not there with all these competing projects. I would need a separate call with you. Maybe we'll do a follow-up show on just the metropolitan New York area. $100 million in competing transportation projects in the metro New York area that people are proposing in the next 5 to 20 years, competing against each other with no defined funding source as yet.
This, you know, that seems to be almost the same methodology that they use when they talk about economic development, whether they want to build a new housing project or a new biotechnology operation somewhere. But at the end of the day, they're always looking for a letter of commitment from some governmental source to begin the whole process. And everything else then gets ratcheted up along the line, and the banks will give the loans and so on and so forth. But it's always deficient. And so how would we even consider a $6 billion outlay when even the federal government seems to be constrained financially at this moment? Well, that could change. You never know. But that's their outcry. So
well,
that's
a good observation. The Federal Transit Administration provides about $1.4 billion a year in various formula grants to the MTA, and they've passed along to the various operating agencies. Metro North and Long Island Railroad each get about 15%. And the federal government is so generous, we always ask for a 20% local share, hard cash, but the Federal Transit Administration for 20 years has accepted something called toll credits, which are funds that have already been spent for other transit projects as a credit. So in essence, what your listeners are not aware of is Uncle Sam in Washington is extraordinarily generous for any Federal Transit Administration project, with the exception of New Starts projects like East Side Access or Second Avenue Subway. Uncle Sam is picking up 100% of the tab, which is which is pretty generous, but you have some significant funding conflicts coming up in the horizon with the next MTA 2020-2024 five-year capital plan. First of all, this particular project, Metro North Penn Station Access, is short a minimum of $605 million, which they need in the next 2024 five-year capital plan. It's competing against Second Avenue Subway, which needs another $1.7 billion to bring it up to $4 billion, so they can leverage that for $2 billion in New Starts funding. To complete East Side Access and Mainline Third Track, they need $1 billion each. And as you know, the long-term capital needs for Metro North, Long Island Railroad, and Transit Authority far exceed the estimated average $30 billion in the next five-year capital plan. That doesn't even include Andy Byford's proposed $40 billion plan, to 10-year plan, action plan to renovate the subway system. He's looking for $17 billion, and there's a big outcry to make 50 subway stations ADA accessible. That could cost several billions. There's also an outcry for several billion for new subway cars. So it's going to be a very difficult political decision for the MTA in the next five-year capital plan over who's going to get what share of money. And there's no guarantee that the Penn Station Metro North Access Project will come in for $1.3 billion. As the project progresses through the environmental review, preliminary final design engineering, then you bid the project out for construction, and there are change orders during the course of construction, the project cost could go out. I point out to your listeners that this project was anticipated to be $350 million in 1999, $700 million in 2014, $1 billion a few years later, now $1.3 billion, and they've yet to begin preliminary design engineering. So who even knows what the final cost of Metro North Penn Station Access could be? Could end up being $2 billion or more. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, that's what I was contemplating with all these concerns and the constraints on and limitations of how many trains can be even accommodated at Penn Station. Is Penn Station the only place that should be considered for all these competing projects? Is it possible to build outside of Penn Station and build something somewhere else, maybe closer to the water's edge, or... I have no idea where you would do it. You can't build on top of Penn Station, and I think it would cost an absolute fortune to clear land around Penn Station if you want to expand it somehow. That would be astronomical. So,
no, it's
anyone
really
contemplating
not
a plan?
It's really
not feasible.
It's no. A long time ago, for Long Island Railroad East Side Access, they were contemplating building a terminal by Bloomingdale's at 59th and Lex, but they decided to go into Grand Central Terminal. You could build, there's a promise to build a Sunnyside station for Long Island Railroad, where Long Island Railroad, Metro North, and Amtrak could intercede, and that would make an interesting possibility. You would avoid the conflicts of congestion in the East River tunnels and avoid the conflict of congestion at Penn Station. And hypothetically, Metro North, if they extended service as far as an intermodal station at Sunnyside Yards, Metro North wires could switch at Sunnyside Yards and get to a Long Island Railroad train to Penn Station. But in all honesty, given the cost of construction of new terminals in Manhattan, it's really doubtful. But I think you have to keep in mind our economy is changing and more people are telecommuting, more and more people are working from home or working in the suburbs. The concept of Manhattan as the center of the universe, I think, has long changed. The financial district in Wall Street now is becoming heavy residential. So if you look at where we're going to be 10, 20, 30 years from now, I would argue hypothetically more and more people are going to be working from home or working at jobs in the outer boroughs or suburbs rather than coming into Manhattan.
That's what I've always thought of, because it seems that these projects are based on something that's 20 or 30 years old, and they're bringing it forward without input from the changing dynamics. As you say, the telecommuting, more and more people can't even afford to live in the city, so they are working outside in the suburbs or Long Island or Westchester and New Jersey, and that almost demands telecommuting. And not as much travel in and out of the city.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing you should look at is the Transit Authority is committing to communication-based train controls, very similar to positive train control, where they can speed up their capacity. So hypothetically, this $1.3 billion investment, would it be better spent with a fraction of that money expanding the pool of express buses from the Bronx and Westchester into Manhattan and lower Manhattan, or increasing feeder bus service to the northernmost subway stations, like, for example, in the subway station near Co-op City, the number 6 Parktrexter line. It always amazed me when they built Co-op City in the 60s on the site of the old Freedom Land. If they had extended the number 6 subway one stop directly into Co-op City, those thousands of residents in Co-op City would have had a direct subway ride into Manhattan. So if you're going to invest all this money to upgrade the signal system, tracks and stations and the transit authority subway system in the next 10 years, would that hypothetically be a better investment than the $1.6 billion into Metro North Penn Station access? I don't really know. You also, everyone seems to be forgetting about Penn Station access on the Hudson line via the Amtrak corridor, which is another possibility, far cheaper.
Absolutely. And they haven't used that for some reason. I don't know why. Because of your article, I started to think about it, and it really started to stir up some introspection into what's going on. Not that it always conforms to what we need here in the United States, or certainly not in the New York metropolitan area. In Europe, they're very big on these trolleys that traverse the streets, and you don't have to have the same support as you would in a Metro North station or those trains that would come in. Couldn't those be less expensive to feed into the city if that really is the final conclusion and that enough people would require that? So that you might just take up half of a street going north or south.
Well, trolleys are an interesting concept. They're used in other parts of the country. I would argue that limited stop bus service or select bus service is better because a trolley you're kind of stuck on a fixed rail and you can't move the equipment or system around as neighborhoods or businesses change. They've always talked about, for example, a 42nd Street trolley for decades, but it never reached fruition.
Yes.
They are talking about investing $2.6 billion in some sort of trolley system to connect Brooklyn and Queens along the waterfront, but that's really going nowhere.
So with the bus service, it would be better. And then even the bus systems are now getting to be so sophisticated that it's very likely that you don't even have to have people driving it. It would be automatic. And so it's almost like a robotic thing. And yet you could still tell it what to do through some form of telecommunication in case there's an issue. That's a cheaper way to go, huh?
Well, I think that's a long way off. First, we have to see if the self-driving automobile kicks into place. But always remember, unions have a very powerful influence in transportation, and rightfully so. They want to negotiate contracts.
Yeah.
They want to preserve jobs. So always remember, if they ever hypothetically eliminated a driver, you had a driverless bus, the unions would have a big say. Where do their employees go? For example, you have tollless connections now on some of the TBTA bridges around the city. All those toll collectors didn't disappear. There was no savings in the TBTA budget. They've just been transferred to other jobs. So unions play a big role in terms of the employees' salary and benefits, and they seem to have the upper hand in negotiating contracts with commuter rail systems and the subways versus management.
Okay. Well, I don't begrudge them holding on to their job, but again, the technology is moving ahead, so it's going to be interesting to see how we balance those two aspects and if there is a cost saving at all.
Yeah, and it's an interesting story. The Governor Cuomo's $1.6 billion Moynihan train hall sounds great in theory. One of the facilities there will be Long Island Railroad moving their ticket office over there. More and more people buy weekly and monthly tickets through the mail or through machines, or they use apps. So why are we investing $1.6 billion in a new terminal hall, which is really going to be used by a handful of Amtrak riders? Most Long Island Railroad, New Jersey Transit riders run to Penn Station, grab their train, and go home or exit Penn Station. So is that the best use of scarce taxpayers' money? The $1.6 billion Moynihan train hall adds no additional capacity through the Amtrak and New Jersey Transit or future Metro North connections to Penn Station.
You know what's so compelling about what you're talking about, the subject matter, is how is it conceivable that when you were when you were there with the responsibility to do all these things, it's almost like intuitive. It's like you feel it, you sense it, you recognize it, and you can validate all these aspects, and you can put it together and deconstruct it and reconstruct it again. And you have so many different concepts of how to move something around or to respond to the needs or what will impact this or that or the other. How is it conceivable that the people who are now in charge don't recognize it? Or is there a political overlay that almost tries to quiet the, not that they're naysayers or contrarian to anything, it's just that there's a logic to this, isn't it? There's a financial wherewithal, there's a landscaping wherewithal, equipment wherewithal, people wherewithal, and changing demographics with people telecommuting or not. How is that? Why the disparity?
Well, we would argue when we were, I was working at the Federal Transit Administration, our office was downtown in Wall Street, so we considered ourselves transportation investment portfolio counselors, and we would challenge those who had we'd have these annual program or project meetings with various MTA and non-MTA operating agencies. We'd ask them, well, what is your game plan for this particular project? What are the benefits? What financial resources are you contributing? Do you have a staffing plan, an oversight management plan? Do you have a local share? How are you going to deal with cost overruns and stuff? And we'd ask them one of the most basic questions: if you think this project is worthwhile and we couldn't fund it federally, would you fund it with local funds? And we'd always joke around that we get a Jackie Gleason humming, 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 because we were telling these federal funds are taxpayers' money. It's not funny money. We felt we had a moral and legal obligation that the taxpayers and writers would get their money's worth. And you're very astute. The management, the presidents and chairman of the MTA and Metro North and Long Island Railroad, they're beholden to the governor and the elected officials. They have a lot of sway over and influence over the agencies, and very often the agencies have to listen to the elected officials, and even if they don't think the project is totally worthwhile, if Governor Cuomo says jump, people will say how high, and that's how it is.
Yeah.
And I point out to our conversation in the beginning, I've never seen anyone from MTA headquarters or any of the operating agencies challenge the governor or other elected officials on a major transportation project. Well, we don't think it's necessary, or we have a higher priority. We would always ask that we first fund safety and state of good repair. Let's do the basics first, stations, fleet, power, tracks, signals, interlockings, yard and shops, before you engage in system expansion. Because if your core system is not working well, it really doesn't make sense to expand the system, which can increase your operating deficit and increase maintenance costs. And that's very challenging. Elected officials love to go to ribbon-cutting ceremonies like they did when they announced the Metro North Penn Station access and put the shovel in the ground.
Right.
When it comes to the basics of maintenance, you never see an elected official walking the tunnel with a track person, seeing how the federal or local dollars are being spent on basic maintenance. It's just not sexy.
Uh-huh. Well, it's fascinating, though. But can one be really quite adept at one's venue and discipline, or does it always get eclipsed by the political cloud of the politicians on the scene? Oh, it doesn't matter who, but each one has their own little fiefdom. So does logic lose its prowess or its meaning at the end of the day?
Very, very often logic will prevail. My hat's off to the thousands of transit professionals, from the maintenance guys swinging a pickaxe on the tracks to the people in the yard and shops who work. The real challenge is senior management level, when they have to make the tough decisions. And very often, I have an old saying, tan staff, like no such thing as a free lunch. And it's easy to promise no fare hike or a discount in fares, but in reality, you're cutting your own throat, because it takes money to run the system, between the cost of power, pensions, salaries, maintenance, and basic day-to-day expenses. There's just no way around it, and it's just a very difficult task when you want to manage your budget and you're under political pressure to go this way or that way. And it's tough for transit professional on a management level to tell an elected official after they meet with them, well, your new project sounds great, but we have no money to do it, no capacity. So very often what happens is they spend money on what we call these feasibility studies. So they'll spend a couple $1 million on a study to look at a concept. The study's complete. It ends up the project's really not feasible, and the study goes to what I call a Bermuda Triangle of unfunded transportation studies. And when I worked at my old job, I would ask the first thing they would do in a planning study, I would say, do a literature search, see if someone's looked at this idea before in the past 5 or 10 years. And each generation of elected officials promises something which they believe is new, but I find, ironically, it's always already been looked at 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and that's the challenge we face. It's very difficult to maintain accountability as senior management people at MTA or non-MTA transit agencies come and go and transit professionals come and go. I always felt life is a learning experience, and you should build on the past, and very often it doesn't happen, which is sad.
What's sad is that people don't recognize the history and don't even try to inquire if there is history. So you're ahead of the game. A lot of the knowledge that we have is forgotten as people age and leave their profession or die, and it's just gone. And we don't have this continuity. And it's a failing, I think, all over. I don't know if we're in the United States, we're more attuned to forgetting, and maybe because we're a very young country and we think everything is going to be an innovation. In Europe, they tend to reflect a little bit more. I don't know if they're more successful than we, that's for sure, but they may know a little bit more about history. But is this now a problematic all over the world? Because there's so much competition as well. The Chinese are building trains. We're trying to build trains. The Germans and the French are trying to build trains. Who's going to pay for all of this?
That's a very good question. And we have something which increases project costs called Buy America Rules and Regulations. When you receive a grant from the Federal Transit Administration, you have to buy America for steel and equipment and stuff. And then Governor Cuomo put in Buy New York State Regulations. So that increases transportation project costs, and there's cargo preference and Fly America costs. And in Europe and other countries around the world, they're investing far more than we are in, I guess, what you call high-speed rail and new technology. But we have a challenge in the Northeast Corridor, for example. Everyone's talked about Amtrak having high-speed rail to go 150, 200 miles an hour. But the problem is with the density around the cities on the Northeast Corridor from Washington to Philadelphia to New York and Boston, there's so many curves on the track. The Federal Railroad Administration did a feasibility study a few years ago about implementing high-speed rail in the Northeast Corridor. I think the cost was something between $40 and $100 billion. It's just not feasible because, for whatever reason, when we built our rail systems 100 years ago, no one thought about the future, and they accepted all the curves. And with the economic development around cities, it's very difficult to institute high-speed rail in a lot of parts of the Northeast Corridor, for example, where people might benefit by it.
Well, interestingly enough, Tesla Musk? He was thinking of creating a tunnel underground so that he could travel, or his assistants could travel underground and probably build under. I don't know how expensive it is to build under a city or alongside a city as they're already in place. I mean, you can't move New York City to the side, can you? Or Boston or Philadelphia. It just is what it is. It's there. But it seems like a brilliant idea. But maybe it's just something that you do in the rural districts of the nation.
His concept's interesting. They have a proposal in California for high speed rail, and the cost is like $120 billion over like 20 years or something. They built one small segment to make elected officials happy. The small segment they built was in the middle of nowhere in a very rural part of the corridor. So I go back to my original comments that I think you have to spend greater emphasis on what I call spending money on safety and state of good repair. And if you look at Metro North and the MTA and Long Island Railroad and the Transit Authority, they're short easily 50, 60 billion minimum just to bring Metro North, Long Island Road, and Transit Authority to a state of good repair for track signals, powers, fleet, yard and shop, interlockings, et cetera.
Right.
And I think that's really important just to maintain the existing system before you talk about major system expansion.
Well, you're so right. There was an incident that happened in the Riverdale section of the Bronx, right across the Harlem River, and the system somehow took the curve a little bit too quickly and it derailed. And we've been talking about having some sort of system, a mechanism to ameliorate this into the future, but it still hasn't been engaged. It's because of financial reasons, isn't that?
It's also priorities. I think you're talking about positive train control, which in 2010, the Federal Railroad Administration said which was supposed to be up and running by 2015. Now, you would think safety and security for ridership would be a number one priority for Metro North and Long Island Railroad. So it came out in 2010. 2015 was the due date. Everyone missed it. Everyone got an extension to 2018. The Long Island Railroad, where I live on the island, only the Port Washington branch has met the requirements. So they want yet another extension to 2020. Now, they had the opportunity, both Metro North and Long Island Railroad, to access Federal Transit Administration funding for positive train control. They decided not to. They felt they had higher priorities. And that's the perfect example of safety and state of good repair versus system expansion. Where do you allocate? You have scarce resources. There are only so many certified signal maintainers, for example. There's only so many Amtrak force account signal maintainers and support you need. Why wasn't positive train control made a higher priority for both Metro North and Long Island Railroad if management knew the original due date was 2015? You got an extension to 2018. I'm not quite sure where Metro North is at, but 100% positive train control means it's up and running on every mile of track in any active passenger service area. It means they have received the maintenance plans from the manufacturer for every asset and component to make sure it reaches its full useful life, and they released retainage and made final payment to the vendor. These are things the public is really not aware of. Very often elected officials or transit senior management people say, well, my project's complete, and it's really 98-99% complete. In my line of work, I would ask them, well, you've got beneficial use. Sounds great. What's going to happen between beneficial use and actual final completion, which means acceptance of maintenance plans for the assets, inspection, acceptance of everything, and you release retainage and final payment to the vendor? That in itself can take a year or two. And these are very significant issues when you have a major investment. Second Avenue Subway, if you remember a couple of years ago, went to beneficial use. There was a big ceremony. Everyone didn't talk about the fire prevention system was not up and running. It wasn't until 6 months later that the fire prevention system was actually up and running. Again, a very significant safety and security issue. They had to spend a lot of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, hiring employees to serve as like fire watchmen at all three stations to make sure that nothing was going on. So you have a very good observation there about safety. I remember that horrible accident in Riverdale. Same thing with grade crossings.
Yes,
I mean, grade crossings are a big issue in Metro North territory as well as Long Island Railroad territory. Everyone knows where the street-level grade crossings are. I mean, it's common sense to make the appropriate improvements with adequate signage and bells and whistles, you know, and alarms going off when people approach it. Why are there still locations in Metro North territory and Long Island Railroad that don't have the most up-to-date, you know, safety barriers in place?
I don't either. Couldn't understand that myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's interesting, though? I'm not sure if I'm correct, so you'll probably be able to correct me if I'm wrong. In the Spuitendijl, which is interesting because it's Dutch, it's the Devil's Point. So the Spuitendijl curve in Riverdale, where the derailment took place, I think that the findings were that they blamed also the operator of the train, that there was probably a medical issue with him, and he may have fallen asleep around that curve, and somehow the mechanism wasn't there to take care of, you know, slow down the train as it came toward that area. So they don't have the safety standard there. Why then? Wouldn't it be a lot cheaper if we would consider testing people to see if they're suffering from some malady as we get older? Sometimes we may fall asleep for whatever reasons. Is there any way to ameliorate it from that perspective, which would probably be less expensive?
Well, I think employees are subject to random drug testing on a routine basis. I'm not sure if they're subject on a regular basis to sleep apnea testing. That's a good question. I guess you'd have to ask somebody at Metro North or Long Island Road. But I think that's a good idea. It's the same thing with people who drive. I mean, I'm 65 now, and I have no driver's license. I always was dependent on transportation and my wife driving. But I think it's fair for just as senior citizens at some point, whether it's 70, 75, or 80, should be, you know, retested for driver license renewals. I think that's a good point about people being tested for employees for sleep apnea. I think they may be. I'm not really sure. I'm not really familiar. But again, also unions have very tight contracts with management, so they're going to want to make sure their interests are protected. But I think that's a very reasonable observation. But you have to wonder if positive train control was in place at the time, would that have not happened? Also, you have a problem with work rules with the commuter rails that you cannot hire part-time employees. And I understand you want to protect, you know, seniority and employees, you know, rights and stuff, but I would think it would be more cost-effective when you need more employees rush hour to, as engineers on trains or as token collectors. Why not allow the flexibility for the MTA, commuter rails, and the subway and bus system to hire, you know, part-time employees? There are plenty of people who are semi-retired, who'd love to have a part-time job. And I wouldn't be advocating layoffs of existing employees, but I would think if you want to have cost containment for MTA and the commuter rails, bus, and subway, why not the next union contract negotiate the ability for, you know, part-time employees as appropriate? Couldn't hurt.
Very, very interesting. Well, I guess there are a lot of things that need to be contemplated by many people, but there doesn't seem to be a political will also in many respects, not just in this, in everything from a political perspective, from the small little hyper-local community to the grand scale, even, I guess, on the federal level and everything in between. It just seems easier to throw out a little bit of fluff and people getting excited about that and not even realizing if it ever gets completed in their lifetime or in any other lifetime. And that's where we sit. Considering all the years that you were involved in the transportation business, did you see changes that you found to be credibly more positive as you increased your time in the field? Or
did I get
too impressed by politics?
No, I did, because people understood we have engineering oversight, independent consultants do oversight on projects over $100 million.
Yeah.
And as the years went by and we had meetings with the various MTA operating agencies, and I felt there was a pride, and they understood where we were coming from, that it was taxpayers' money, not funny money. And I thought they did a better job with the federally funded projects in terms of proper scoping and having sufficient staff and track outages and oversight to bring in the projects on time and on budget, and they would do a better job documenting change orders. We would always ask if a project cost increased and there was change order over $100,000, there's a federal requirement to justify it. We would ask for something called a project management plan, generic for any capital project we fund, and specific if the project was over a certain threshold. I think it was $100 million, and they took great pride in bringing federal projects on time and on budget. I'll give you a quick story. The Long Island Railroad had cost overrun projects in the Holman Hillside Maintenance Program facility in the late 80s, and they were suspended from federal funding for 18 months, which is very rare. The federal government took a strong stance. So they were in what I call the doghouse of the program. I came on, was assigned as project manager for Long Island Railroad, and within 2 years, they reestablished what we called their technical capacity. And I said at a meeting with them, a capital program progress review meeting, I'm proud of what you've accomplished under the late Chuck Hoppe, who was the president then. I told them you went from the doghouse to the penthouse of the federally funded capital program, because they were bringing projects in on time and on budget. Chuck Hoppe took my quote, and it was widely used throughout the industry, that they went from the doghouse to the penthouse. So I think there are good people there, but I think you're correct. As we said earlier in our conversation, their political will to tell people what the truth is in terms of what's realistic to be implemented or not and what the real cost is just not there. Everyone wants 10 staff. There ain't no such thing as a free lunch or transit project or ride. Mm-hmm. Fares, for example, are always going to go up. And elected officials who demagogue like the Roman Empire, free bread and circuses, I'm not going to have a fare increase. It'll be frozen. It's just not going to happen. Just like your cost of living goes up when you buy milk, bread, or pizza, the fare is going to go up, like it or not. And no one has the political will to say this is reality.
That it will. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that you are so informed and that you have a standard of excellence that you bring to the forefront? And your team was a small number of people, but evidently you had oversight, billions and billions of dollars, and definitely respected by everyone that, had some sort of discourse with you. But do you find that still to be the case, or is that an old standard, an old ethical conduct that may be just dying out because political overplay is too strong?
Well, I've been retired for 4 years now, but I would say I still stay in touch with my colleagues periodically. I think for the federally funded portion of the MTA and the Operating Agency Capital Program, I think it's still there. And the problem is Diogenes is looking for that brave soul to speak up. And we were never wallflowers. I and my handful of people, right? I'd have one engineer, one grants person managing the whole Metro North Capital Program, federally funded, which at any given time could be, the portfolio could be $500 million, $800 million. And maybe we have an independent engineering consultant helping us out on a handful of projects of $100 million. And we'd review, like I said, their quarterly progress reports, interim milestones, and making sure they had a good quality assurance, quality control plan, good staffing plan, sufficient staff. And with, I think I and my staff were well-respected in the industry. We're very kind. We're a handful of people. I would always say we work in Wall Street. We're transportation investment portfolio counselors with billions of dollars.
Right.
We're not making the big bucks that our friends in Wall Street and the private sector are making. But with us and with me in particular, I felt it was personal pride. If the project came in at the end of the day on time and on budget with a minimum amount of change orders and the ridership and taxpayers were benefiting by it, I came home and told my wife, I felt proud I accomplished something. You know, there's always the stereotype of the pointed-headed, you know, federal bureaucrat, you know, who doesn't know what he's doing, what she's doing, and they don't contribute. I always felt we made sure the taxpayers got their money's worth.
Yeah.
So I kind of felt we broke the stereotype. And I was born in Brooklyn. Your word is your bond. Frankie Valli, the Four Seasons, never had a legal contract with Bob Gaudia, his partner, for 50 years. They did business with a handshake.
Yeah.
And I was very proud of my 31 years. I very rarely sent out a nasty letter to anybody. I always felt your word is your bond, and I was straight up with people. They were straight up with me, what was feasible, what was not feasible. And I was proud of what I accomplished with my handful of people in my 31 years working for the federal government in transportation.
Well, that's what comes out in your biography, and your accomplishment is truly unbelievable. I don't find that's the standard of the day, but then again, I'm 69, so maybe what do I know? I'm getting to be an old man. And
we're both seniors.
But, you know, yeah, we're both definitely seniors. So it's just fascinating that this is difficult. But did you find, from other than transportation, were you contrarian, not because you wanted to be a contrarian in any way, but the facts allowed you to postulate what was going on, and by doing so, that may have put some people off. How did you find the balance? Because that's the hardest thing today. People do not know how to balance facts and truths and misnomers and still be able to give it expression without offending people. How does that happen? Where did you learn that?
I think it's very difficult. One of my old bosses said you get more with Honegger. One of my old bosses had a saying, you get more with honey than vinegar. So I was always straight up with people, compliment them on all the good stuff they're doing, but then point out to them the risks and downside if you go in one direction versus another. So I find in retirement, I love, you know, speaking to people like yourself and sharing my knowledge with the taxpayers and writing public. And my goal, I like to support safe, cost-effective mass transit. I feel I've been doing that since I started working in the field in 1983, and now in retirement. I love sharing my knowledge and wisdom, and it's only a handful of people willing to tell it like it is. It's very easy to get along, go along.
Yes.
It takes a strong-willed person, which I thought I and my limited staff were in my previous mm-hmm. job profession. Now, as a private citizen, I just enjoy sharing my knowledge and wisdom with people. I think it's life
Absolutely.
Is a learning experience. Each day you learn something new.
Absolutely. It never ends until the good Lord takes you away. So who knows? It's probably a bigger experience up there. Or if there is a there, we'll find out eventually. What brought you into the transportation business? Was it railroads that got you excited about that? Was there anything that informed you as a young child? Was it a book that you read? How did you even get into this field?
Always interested in transportation, and I grew up in Brooklyn, and I spent a lot of time running buses and subways and commuter rail. So I was always fascinated and interested in transportation. And as I said in our conversation earlier, I live and breathe transportation because I was always living near a subway station. I never got a driver's license, which I don't have to this day. So I always joked around, you know, meeting people that I really am vested in public transportation because not only do I help fund it, but I actually use it. And I think it's a cost-effective way to get around. Not everyone can use public transportation. I mean, in the urban areas, yes, and in the inner suburbs, yes. You still, a lot of people need a car to get around, which is the basics. But if you can drive your car to a subway station or a suburban commuter rail station, then you can get mass transit to come in. If you can afford the parking fees in Manhattan, and goodness knows what congestion pricing might be priced out of existence. But I just enjoy public transportation. I think it's a good benefit. And it's a great equalizer, whether you're poor, rich, old, or young. I just find it fascinating when you ride a bus or subway. It's a melting pot of America when you're on a bus or subway or commuter rail, all ages and creeds,
it really
ethnicities,
is.
And religions. And brings us all together for a little period of time.
Absolutely. It's a good way to go. I like it too. Well, I want to thank you for your time and for your input and for your knowledge and for sharing it and for just being an upstanding guy, which is a rare situation nowadays. Thank you very much. I hope you'll consider coming back in the future and we could delve into it even more on different concerns. So we'll leave that up to you and we'll see where that goes.
Absolutely. I could probably fill a whole other show on just the intricacies of the Metro North Penn Station Access Project. We didn't have time to get into, but I'm so glad you shared my article with the your listeners and readers.
Yes.
And I definitely look forward to coming back on another show talking about the same project or just other transportation projects or transportation in general. And thank you for affording me the opportunity to share my knowledge and wisdom with the riding public and taxpayers and citizens.
Well, thank you. It's been immeasurable. All the best to you, sir. Thank you very much. Well, there we have it, folks. What a wonderful, wonderful guest. You know, it's so rare nowadays to have people that are knowledgeable. They're willing to share the facts. It's not sullied in any way by agenda or dogma. But it's based on an understanding of the issues, how it impacts, how it detracts, how it embellishes. There are just so many aspects, and not everyone has that capacity to measure and balance and equate what is and what isn't and what would work and what wouldn't work. And the most important, probably, is the fact that here's a guy who knows how to celebrate people, but at the same time also knows how to deal with the reality and also to look at the needs of a public interest, the needs of business, the needs of employees and workers that manage this transportation system throughout the metropolitan area and beyond. Just a really, really fascinating. What a pleasure to have spoken to him today. Well, let's take a quick break, find out what's going on in the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back after the commercial.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hesse is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hesse, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hesse Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Well, welcome back. One thing that came about yesterday's presidential speech was that there was a very, very strong consideration that the United States would withdraw some of its troops from Afghanistan. Well, it seems that the U.S. vowed to withdraw half its troops from Afghanistan, so say the Taliban. Well, so it seems a senior Taliban official told reporters in Moscow on Wednesday that the U.S. had vowed to withdraw half of its troops from Afghanistan by April of this year. The U.S., however, has issued no details of a potential troop pullout from the war-ravaged country. So speaking to reporters in the Russian capital a week after the Taliban held separate talks with U.S. officials in Qatar, the Taliban's deputy chief negotiator, Abdul Salman Hanafi, said that the U.S. had agreed to withdraw half their troops from Afghanistan by the end of April. So the Americans agreed to withdraw half of their troops immediately. The withdrawal would start from February 1st or so and continue until the end of April, Hanafi told reporters in Moscow. So, but the U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, who led the U.S. side at the talks in Doha, Qatar, has repeatedly stressed that, quote, nothing is agreed upon until everything is agreed upon. So everything must include an intra-Afghan dialogue and a comprehensive ceasefire. And the U.S. has issued no details on any potential withdrawal plan as of yet. So the Afghan government was not represented at both the talks in Doha or in Moscow, and sparking fears among many Afghans that a hasty pullout of U.S. troops would once again plunge the war-ravaged country into a brutal civil war. So the absence of Afghan government representatives at the talks have underscored the Taliban's hostility toward Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, increasingly marginalized the administration in Kabul. So the Taliban has instead sat down at the table in Moscow with Ghani's main rivals, including Afghan politicians and warlords that turned politicians who were once sworn enemies of the hardline Sunni Islamist group. The second day of peace talks in Moscow began hours after U.S. President Donald Trump used his State of the Union address to stress the importance of accelerated Taliban to end the longest of America's endless wars. And Trump offered no specifics about when he would bring home the 14,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, but said that progress in negotiations with the Taliban would enable a troop reduction and a focus on counterterrorism. So asked about Trump's speech, a Taliban official in Moscow told Reuters that all foreign troops in Afghanistan must leave. Quote, at the first step, we want all the foreign forces to leave and end the military presence in our country, said Sohail Shaheen, a spokesman for a Taliban office in Qatar. But after ending their military presence, their non-military teams can come and we need them too. They can come and take part in the reconstruction and development process, he added. So Taliban officials have used extraordinary exposure at the Moscow talks to detail their vision of Afghanistan after a U.S. troop withdrawal. Lead Taliban negotiator Sher Mohammed Abbas Stanikazi told reporters that the movement did not want to rule alone, but as part of an intra-Afghan Islamic system of governance in consultation with all Afghans. Well, I've heard lines like that before, but we'll see. He also reiterated the Taliban's opposition to Afghan's constitution, calling it, quote, illegitimate. and maintaining that it should be based on Islamic principles, national interests, historic pride, and social justice. Well, okay, so Steinitzai told and demanded the removal of Western sanctions and travel bans on Taliban members, prisoner releases, an end of propaganda against the Taliban, and clearance to open an official office. So on the critical side of women's rights, Steinitzai said the Taliban was committed to all rights of women, quote, that have been given to them by the sacred religion of Islam. Okay, so that is still questionable because the standards of Islamic law with regard to women is not so modern in its allowance of women. Look at the changes that are happening in the Middle East all over from Islamic nations. Women weren't allowed to drive, now they are. They weren't allowed to have a job, now they are. So all of these things come into play, and sometimes the religious aspects may be too stringent on women. And one of the problems, too, is that you have honor killings in the Middle East, including enough. In some places, women cannot even walk out of their home unless they're accompanied by a male, like a father, like a husband, or even a child. Can you imagine? So there are differences, and you also have to wonder if American sensibilities are attuned to this. And unless you study a little bit about Islam, maybe not everything, but you need to be understanding of these cultures. They're different. They have different thinking, different processes, different reactions. I spent a tremendous amount of time at the insistence of the dictator at the time, President Al-Haq Zia. I went to Pakistan, spent about a month, month and a half there, traveling the country at his behest, because he was hoping that I could energize interest in Pakistan as a destination, particularly for people that had a Pakistani ancestry who had moved to the United States as well as Europe and would consider taking their grandchildren to see the old homeland. So very, very compelling. And what a beautiful country. But at the same time, you also saw the differences of culture and religion all fused into one difference. And when one travels, at least, one can get a sense of the differences. But at the end of the day, we're all human. But still, there are differences to celebrate and to question. Sometimes they'd be worthwhile adopting, sometimes not. That's up to the individual, of course. So very, very compelling situation there with the news. Let me just quickly go back to our studio screen and find out what else is going on in our neck of the woods. Let's find out what they're doing at the Cabot Creamery.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
Can I get to wear a yellow lab coat?
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Well, this is mind-boggling. I never knew that this was happening in the church, but evidently Pope Francis has acknowledged that priests, bishops, sexually abused nuns. Well, Pope Francis admitted yesterday that priests and bishops in the Catholic Church had sexually abused nuns. There are some priests and also bishops who have done it, the pontiff had said in response to a journalist's question on the abuse of nuns, speaking on the return flight from his trip to the United Arab Emirates. The papal admission followed a rare outcry last week from the Vatican's Women's Magazine over the sexual abuse of nuns by priests and religious sisters feeling forced to have abortions or raise children not recognized by their fathers. The headlines last year after a nun accused an Indian bishop of repeatedly raping her in a case that triggered rare dissent within the country's Catholic Church. Francis said the problem could be found anywhere, quote unquote, but was prevalent in some new congregations and in some regions. I think it's still going on because it's not something that just goes away like that. On the contrary, he added. He said the church has, quote, suspended several clerics, end quote, and the Vatican has been, quote, working on the issue for a long time, end quote. I don't want to hear it said that the church has not got this problem, because it has. Must we do more? Yes. Do we want to? Yes, he said. The February issue of Women Church World, a supplement distributed by the Vatican's Osservatore Romano newspaper, warned that the nuns have been silent over abuse for decades for fear of retaliation. It said the Vatican received reports of priests abusing nuns in Africa in the 1990s. Quote, if the church continues to close its eyes to the scandal, made even worse by the fact that abuse of women brings about procreation and is therefore at the origin of forced abortions in children who aren't recognized by priests, the oppression of women in the church will never change. That's what editor Lucetta Scarafia had told and written. My goodness. It's amazing how much we've learned over so many years as we age. Which is, my God, unbelievable. Now let's hear something else that's going on. There is talk about Vietnam, a compromise pick for the Trump-Kim meeting. Well, it seems that Vietnam, a communist state that has embraced capitalism and longtime North Korea ally, will be hosting U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un for their second summit later this month. The venue has assets for both parties. During his annual State of the Nation address yesterday, Trump said he would be holding his second meeting with the North Korean leader in Vietnam on February 27 to 28. Asia Nation is a symbolic pick for North Korea because it was split in two more than 20 years ago during the height of the Cold War, as was the Korean Peninsula. Vietnam and North Korea have had diplomatic relations since 1950, and Pyongyang even supported the communist North during the Vietnam War, sending Air Force troops as reinforcements. But from an economic point of view, bilateral trade has declined between the two countries as a result of the sanctions imposed by the United Nations against North Korea. Now, Kim Jong-un has never been to Vietnam. His grandfather, Kim Il-sung, was the last North Korean leader to visit the Southeast Asian nation back in 1958. Well, Kim Jong-un's move could therefore help him consolidate bilateral relations and also learn from Vietnam's economic transformation. In 1986, Vietnam launched its Doi Moi, or all-around renovation process, to try to step up economic growth. And since then, the country has embraced capitalism without forsaking its communist regime, an idea that could seduce the North Korean leader. Now, Vietnam can be a good source of inspiration and reflection for Kim Jong-un, allowing him to think about how he should advance North Korea. Lohong Heap of the Singapore-based Institute of Southeast Asian Studies had told Agence France-Presse. So a Trump-Kim summit would also increase Vietnam's status in the international community, a goal Hanoi has been pursuing since the country hosted the 2017 Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, which was attended by the United States and Chinese presidents. Washington also hopes the Vietnamese model, economic model, will inspire the North Korean leader. Your country can produce and reproduce this path. It's up to you. If you seize this moment, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said last year during a visit to Vietnam. Trump is also trying to limit the growing influence of China, the North Korean regime's main economic backer and diplomatic ally. And during their meeting in January the 4th, in less than a year, Kim Jong-un and Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed to jointly study the negotiations, quote, on the Korean Peninsula, the denuclearization issue in particular. So Trump could use Vietnam to, quote, signal to Beijing that North Korea is not in their hands and that the U.S., quote, can counterbalance Chinese influence. Chong Seong-woon, a visiting scholar of at the Seoul-based Asan Institute for Policy Studies, advised. Vietnam is also highly symbolic for the U.S., especially the central coastal city of Da Nang, which was one of the busiest hubs for U.S. aircraft during the Vietnam War. Hanoi and Da Nang have been floated as possible venues for the upcoming Trump-Kim summit. If Da Nang is chosen, the city, the fourth largest in the country, has dozens of high-end hotels conducive to hosting an event of such magnitude. My goodness, very, very compelling, don't you think? Just a mind blower, if ever there was one. Very, very intriguing. Now, let me just quickly look at something else here. I want to do some stuff of what happened here in the United States, which is important, and tell you what happened with last night's presidential speech. So the Trump border wall overshadows his pitch for unity in the State of the Union address. A very compelling speech. I don't know if you heard it. I hope you did. Donald Trump called for renewed unity in his State of the Union address yesterday, but the stark divisions within U.S. politics were on view as he vowed to build a border wall and blasted federal investigations into his administration. "I will get it built," Trump declared before members of the U.S. Congress on Capitol Hill, referring to the controversial wall along the U.S. border with Mexico that has become the defining battle of his first 2 years in office. While Republican members cheered and applauded, Democrats sat firmly rooted in their seats. Moments earlier, Trump had opened his second State of the Union address, appeal for unity between the country's two major parties. Quote, he said, "We must reject the politics of revenge, resistance, and retribution, and embrace the boundless potential of cooperation, compromise, and the common good," Trump told Congress and a huge television audience. Quote, "We must choose between greatness or gridlock, results or resistance, a vision or vengeance, incredible progress or pointless destruction," Trump said in the speech, which was littered with storming rhetoric and interrupted continuously by applause from his camp. If the words sounded familiar, it was because Trump had, quote, employed much of the same rhetoric a year ago when he stood before the then Republican-controlled House of Representatives to deliver his first State of the Union speech. But whereas it had been Republican Paul Ryan seated behind Trump back then, it was Democrat Nancy Pelosi who now flanked the president on Tuesday night in her recently restored role of Speaker of the House. Her presence was a reminder that in the past 12 months, the divide in U.S. politics has shown no sign of narrowing. It had been Pelosi who had forced Trump to delay his speech, much to the president's chagrin, amid a partial government shutdown that was largely a result of Democrats' refusal to grant funding for Trump's border wall. Now, with a return to shutdown possible, once temporary legislation to reopen government expires on February 15th, Trump shows no signs of backing down over the wall issue, though he did stop short of declaring a national emergency that would allow him to bypass Congress to secure funding for the barrier. "Walls work and walls save lives," he said, as he outlined plans for what he said would be a, quote, smart, see-through steel barrier, end quote. He struck a familiar tone as he evoked the threat of large organized caravans on the march to the United States and savage criminal gangs of illegal immigrants. Trump seemed to be appealing for unity, but strictly on his own terms. In the Democratic response to Trump's speech, Stacey Abrams, who lost a race for governor of Georgia last November, said that while Democrats stood ready to secure the country's ports and borders, quote, America is made stronger by the presence of immigrants, not walls, she said. Responses from Democrats appeared on Twitter during Trump's 82-minute speech. Representative Pramila Jayapal tweeted her opposition to the wall, noting, quote, the border is more than secure than ever. Enough, she said. The president also addressed head-on the other major controversy that has dogged him, his time in office, the ongoing investigation into Trump's links with Russia and its meddling in the election that brought him to power. Quote, an economic miracle is taking place in the United States, he said, as he lauded the country's declining unemployment and growing economy. Quote, and yet the only thing that can stop it is foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations, he said. Quote, if there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way. We must be united at home to defeat our enemies abroad. Almost sounds like a rap song. But with Democrats now in control of the House and readying a slew of investigations into a range of aspects of Trump's administration, that appeal was likely to fall on deaf ears. Turning to foreign policy, Trump repeated his pledge to end direct U.S. involvement in long-running wars in Afghanistan and Syria, policies that have irked many in his own party, let alone across the aisle. Great nations do not fight endless wars, he said. Trump said that the U.S. working to, quote, destroy the remnants, end quote, of the Islamic State group, and that, quote, constructive, end quote, talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan have accelerated. You also announced long-awaited details of a second summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un following their historic meeting in Singapore last year. The two leaders will meet in Vietnam over February 27 and 28, Trump said. There were also pledges to advance policy that is likely to gain partisan support, most notably launching a campaign to end the HIV epidemic in the United States by 2030. But despite all the appeals for unity, it was the divisions on show, particularly when Trump was speaking about immigration, for which Tuesday's speech will likely be remembered. Now, while Republicans erupted into standing ovations throughout Trump's address and occasional chants of USA, USA, the Democrats stayed mostly silent and stony-faced. One exception came when a group of female Democratic lawmakers dressed in white to celebrate the 100th anniversary of American women gaining the right to vote leaped to their feet to cheer when Trump noted there are more women, quote, more women in the workforce than ever before, end quote. You weren't supposed to do that, a surprise, Trump responded. So they were just overwhelmed, evidently, by the facts. So very, 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 very interesting. Let me quickly go back to our studio screen. And let me just see one more thing. Okay, let's just find out what they're doing again at the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
welcome back. If you want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, they've got another number, 347-415-4326. That number is good to text, to leave a voicemail, and is both our office and cell number as well. So, again, 347-415-4326. And so that's the story there. I wanted to check out some other things that you might find interesting. Bear with me one moment. We cover as much as possible with you. This is really quite interesting because the European Commission has rejected the Siemens-Alstom rail merger. Didn't expect that to happen at all. The European Union authorities today rejected a massive rail merger deal between France's Alstom and Germany's Siemens in what the two nations had hoped would have created a global competitor stand up to China. Now, EU Antitrust Commissioner Margrethe Vestager said it would have created a near monopoly in the European market, choking fair competition and leading to higher prices for passengers. In her decision, she withstood political pressure from the European Union's two most powerful nations. The Commission prohibited the merger because the companies were not willing to address our serious competition concerns, she said. Alstom is best known for making France's TGV, Tron Grand Vitesse, and Siemens for Germany's ICE high-speed trains. They also make rail signaling systems. Blocking mergers is rare for the EU Antitrust Office. In three decades, the EU approved more than 6,000 deals and banned less than 30. France condemned the decision even before the official announcement, with Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire saying earlier on Wednesday that Vestager's decision will serve the economic and industrial interests of China. France and Germany wanted to create a European rail giant that could compete with China's state-controlled giant CRRC. Le Maire said that the European Union's move will prevent Alstom and Siemens, the two champions of rail signaling and rail transport, to merge in order to have the same weight as the Chinese big industrial champion. He called it both a political and an economic mistake. It's going to serve China's economic and industrial interests, he said. Le Maire called for a revision of European competition rules, saying that the, quote, the pertinent market for analyzing competition is the world market and not the European market. On Tuesday, German economy minister Peter Altmaier floated the same idea of giving greater weight in competition law to the global as opposed to national or European market. Both the French and German governments defended the merger, but competition authorities in Britain, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Spain expressed concerns that the new company would be in a dominating position that would potentially overpower smaller rail manufacturers and increase prices in the market. Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable what's going on. So, but very compelling news, and that's really what's so important. Bear with me a moment because I just wanted to check something else. One second. And this thing I want to cover with you, and this has to do with Mr. I think he pronounced his name Hosn. He is in jail due to, quote, treason in at Nissan, so he claims. Detained auto tycoon Carlos Hosn believes his arrest and the charges against him are the result of a plot and treason at his former employer, Nissan, he told the Nikkei newspaper today. The Japanese Business Daily quoted Hosn as saying he had, quote, no doubt, end quote, charges against him were motivated by Nissan executives opposed to greater integration of the firm with its French alliance partner, Renault. It was the first press interview Hosen was given or has given since his stunning arrest on November 19, conducted in the Tokyo Detention Center, where he has languished ever since. A Nissan spokesman hit back immediately, saying the current CEO, Hiroto Saikawa, has, quote, already categorically refused the notion of a coup d'etat, end quote. The sole cause of this chain of events is the misconduct led by Hosen and Chief of Staff Greg Kelly, the spokesman had added. He said a Nissan probe had uncovered substantial and convincing evidence of misconduct, end quote, and that the firm's focus is, quote, firmly on addressing the weaknesses in governance, end quote, that allowed this conduct to happen. 64-year-old Mr. Gosen has been denied bail several times, with the court considering him a flight risk and concerned he would attempt to destroy evidence. But he again stressed that he wouldn't flee. I will remain myself, according to the Nikkei. But he again stressed that he won't flee. I will defend myself, he said, according to the Nikkei. All the evidence is with Nissan, and Nissan forbids all employees to talk to me, he added. Even his own lawyer has added it would be a travesty, you know, based on what it is. Well, I see that we've come to the end of the line for us, and got to catch up with some other news as well. So there's no point in staying along with you today till 12, because I've got some projects that need to be completed, and it's been very, very compelling. But I, because of the schedule and responsibilities, certainly that have culminated in the last week or two. Thank you for being with us. Tomorrow is a fascinating day. We're going to be speaking to Lori and John Wiles. They're the dynamic, driving me crazy duo. And, of course, automotive reviewer Wynn Morrow. And so they're going to be on tomorrow. And if we're lucky, we'll be able also to speak to the mayor of Mount Vernon, Richard Thomas. He'll be on from 10:30 to 11. The Wiles and the Driving Me Crazy crowd with Wynn Morrow from 10 to 10:30. We'll engage in an introspection into political news. And that'll be from 10 o'clock in the morning to 10. The mayor is going to be on from 10:30 to 11. So that's the story. Thank you so much. All the best. And thanks to our guest today, Larry Penner. What a brilliant, brilliant, upstanding guy. Couldn't have asked for anyone better than he. He's aware, but he's also such an honest man. Rarely to be found nowadays. And like he said, he was taught to that his word was his contract. That was his handshake. And that's what I learned in my day. So that's the way it goes. All the best and take care. We'll speak to you tomorrow. Goodbye.